starting a, well, not starting a new series. We started last week, so we're continuing this series. This will be our second week in the book of Judges. And if you've ever taken the time to read through the book of Judges, then you'll find out very quickly that it is not the most G-rated book in the Bible. As a matter of fact, some of the things that you read in the book of Judges, you're like, this is, you know, they could not make this into a Christian movie. There's just absolutely no way that they could do it. It's some of the most disturbing, the most violent passages in the book of Judges come from the book of Judges, because this book serves as a testament, as a reminder of what happens when God's people fail to uphold His law. It's a warning to us in the present to heed these warnings from the past. Otherwise, we might find ourselves down some similar trajectory, spiraling down and down and down. Now, I want you to remember we're just going to kind of start off and remind you just the context of the book of Judges. Remember that this is taking place. I don't think my clicker is working currently. This is taking place somewhere in the realm between 1300 and about 1090 BC. It is just a little while after the Exodus. The Exodus is about the 1440s BC. So they've gone through the time of Moses. They've gone through the Exodus. They've entered the Promised Land. They've made their initial stages of settlement into the Promised Land. Thank you. They made their initial stages into the Promised Land, and now they've started to settle the land. And by the death of Joshua, around the late 1300s, then we're told that another generation grows up after the time of the elders who served Joshua, after the time of Joshua, that did not know the Lord. And immediately within just that one generation, you begin to see the nation of Israel spiral out of control. Now, this was their inception. This was their first years in the Promised Land. This is everything that they have longed for, but as soon as they get it, they lose it. Last week, we took a look into the first step toward destruction, and we found that it happened, you know, just about three verses into the book, when the tribe of Judah is told, the people get together, and they say, you know, after the Joshua, they went to the Lord, and they ask the Lord, and they're like, you've got it, good job, you're doing the right thing. They ask the Lord, and the Lord said, Judah is supposed to go up, Judah is supposed to lead the attack to enter the Promised Land, to settle the Promised Land. And Judah immediately in verse 3 turns to the Simeonites, his brothers, and says, how about you go with us? And it starts off this cascading slope of partial obedience. And where we ended up yesterday, last week, it seems like yesterday to me. What we ended up with last week is where we start off today, and that is that once Judah's leadership set the tone, all of the rest of the tribes seem to follow. So, Judges chapter 1, beginning in verse 27, reading on through the end of the chapter. But Manasseh did not drive out the people of Bethshan, or Tanakh, or Dor, or Ablim, or Megiddo, and their surrounding settlements, but the Canaanites were determined to live in that land. When Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but never drove them out completely. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. Neither did Zebulun drive out the Canaanites living in Kitron or Nahalal. So these Canaanites lived among them, but Zebulun did subject them to forced labor. Nor did Asher drive out those living in Acha or Sidon or Alab or Aksib or Helba or Aphek or Rehob. The Asherites lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land because they did not drive them out. Neither did Naphtali drive out those living in Beth Shemesh or Beth Anath, But the Naphtalites too lived among the Canaanite inhabitants of the land, and those living in Beth Shemesh and Beth Anath became forced laborers for them. The Amorites confined the Danites to the hill country, not allowing them to come down into the plain. And the Amorites were determined also to hold out in Mount Heres, Aijalon, Shaalbim. But when the power of the tribes of Joseph increased, they too were pressed into forced labor. The boundary of the Amorites was from Scorpion Pass to Selah and beyond. See, instead of having a unified kingdom, the Israelite nation instead finds itself spread out from settlement to settlement. There are portions of the nation that are divided by cities that were left unconquered. They find themselves living next to their enemies. They find themselves living among their enemies, failing to completely take the city, living in some sort of peace with the inhabitants, subjecting them to slavery. If you can see the areas of compromise here, this was their promised land. This was their inheritance. This is what they were told by God, that they were going to inherit. But they never really went in and grasped hold of it. They never went in and took the inheritance for themselves. Instead, compromise seemed so much easier. So if the first stage that we talked about was partial obedience, the flip side of that coin is that partial obedience will always lead to compromise. To spiritual compromise. And I want to see the divisions that we seem to place here. There are three different ways, there are three different things that the Israelites do to the Canaanites. And first, the people that they lived among, and it says this in verse 32, and I won't scroll back to it, but I'll just read it here. The Asherites lived among the Canaanite inhabitants then because they did not drive them out. That's a pretty clear example of a cultural compromise. They were willing to accept the culture, the customs of the surrounding Canaanite neighbors for their own, for the sake of peace, for the sake of fitting in, for the sake of being relevant. And I really think for the sake of apathy as well. They are, as you move in and they're like, well, you know, they don't want to leave and they're kind of, you know, we don't want to make them. It's just sort of easier just to leave them here. They can just sort of be subsumed into our culture, you know. It'll be fine. It's not that big of a deal. It doesn't matter that whole much. Now, second, they had the people that they put into slavery. And this is crazy to me because they are only a couple hundred years out of their own oppression and slavery. And then they've achieved their freedom. They get their land. And immediately they turn around and they enslave other people groups. Israel sees an economic advantage to using the people they've subjugated as slaves. And in verse 30 it says, you know, now the Zebulun dried up the Canaanites living in Kitchen and Nahala. So the Canaanites live among them, but they did subject them to forced labor. Here's an example of economic compromise, because it was financially expedient the people of God compromised following the word of God. And then there are the people groups that they never even tried to drive out. And we see that with the tribe of Dan, where it says that Dan was confined to the hill country, and he couldn't even come down out of the mountain because the Amorites were down at the bottom of the mountain. And instead of inheriting the promised land, the Danites end up holed off to themselves. There's nowhere they can go because they're surrounded by Amorites. They're just going to live on top of the hill for a while. So keep their culture, keep their economy, keep their gods. All of this led to compromise. And I want you to think about this for a few minutes. I want you to think about what it is Israel was supposed to do. Now, we cannot draw any direct application here from the nation of Israel to the church today, or from the nation of Israel to our nation today. They are not the same. So we have to be very careful when we look at the Old Testament, because we have to look at it in the lens of that culture, of that time period, of that covenant, to see what God is saying to us today. We cannot clearly say, well, it looks like the people of Israel were supposed to drive out all the non-Christians, therefore all the Christians in the United States should drive out all the non-Christians. That's not what he's trying to say here. This is a different covenant, this is a different time. Now, what were Israel's instructions? What were they supposed to do? See, God's words throughout Exodus and Numbers and Deuteronomy and Leviticus was very clear. Drive them out. Drive them out. Get rid of them. Get rid of their influence. Do not intermarry. Do not intermingle. And if the Canaanites resist, if they will not get out, if you cannot drive them out, if they will not leave, then they are to be killed. Now, time out here for a second, because I think this is important to address. Because God's command here to wage war against the Canaanites really stands at odds with what we know of the character of God. As a matter of fact, this particular example here of God saying, "Go and kill them," makes a lot of people believe, whether implicitly or explicitly, that there's a big difference between the God of the Old Testament and the God of the New Testament. And there's a big difference in how God reveals himself in the Old Testament and how he reveals himself in the New Testament. And I've heard it likened by one non-Christian comedian to say that, you know, well, the God of the Old Testament is just like an angry man. That he really doesn't care about anybody. He's just sort of angry. And he's mad, and it's his way or the highway, but then, you know, he has a son, and he just sort of settles down a little bit, and everything's a little bit nicer. And but we can't take that sort of dichotomy. It's not as if God changed. So how then do we reconcile the fact that God is telling the Israelites that it's their duty to wipe out an entire people group? Doesn't this seem like it is completely different than the God that we know as revealed in Jesus? So I want you to listen to what God commanded in Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 16. He says, "And the cities, the nations, the Lord your God has given you as an inheritance. Do not leave anything alive that breathes. Completely destroy them, the Hittites, Amorites, Canaanites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites, as the Lord your God has commanded you. Otherwise, they will teach you to follow all the detestable things they do in worshiping their gods, and you will sin against the Lord your God." And this seems so harsh. It's so heavy, but here's a couple of things we have to realize. See, first of all, the Canaanites were not a nice people. We look at ISIS today, and even that does not reach the level of evil that was ingrained in the culture of the Canaanites. From infant sacrifice to prostitution, they were not an innocent people. And way back in Genesis, God had prophesied to Abraham that his descendants would remain in Egypt until the time of the Canaanites was full, until it was time to judge the Canaanites for their sins. See, God had given them time to repent. He had been patient. It had been over 400 years that he had let this go on. And God has said, enough is enough. The time for judgment has come. Second, God's judgment against the Canaanites is not something that he only wages against the Canaanites. While the Israelites are God's instrument to judge here, as we'll see throughout Israelite history, even later in the book of Judges, that God is equal opportunity. He is not just going to use the people of God to drive out those who are not his people. In fact, throughout Israelite history, you see non-Christian peoples, you see the Philistines, you see even parts of the Canaanites, coming back in being in judgment against Israel for their sin. He uses the Babylonians and the Assyrians to wipe out the Israelites, to dispossess them from their land, to take them to Babylon. God's judgment is not one-sided. He does not favor the Israelites over the rest of the world. In fact, their designation as God's people puts them in God's favor in terms of placing on them more responsibility. The standard to which God calls his people is higher than to that which he has expected of the rest of the unbelieving world. Third, the command to kill those who remain in the land was only the secondary directive of their conquest of the promised land. See, 15 times through Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy, God speaks not of killing everybody, but of driving them out. Exodus chapter 34, verse 11 says, "Obey what I command you today, I will drive out before you the Amorites, Canaanites, Hittites, Perizzites, Hivites, and Jebusites. Same people groups that he's saying completely destroy just earlier in Exodus. See, in the book of Judges, the condemnation of the tribes is not they did not slaughter the Canaanites surrounding them, but that they did not drive them out. In that big long passage, the end of Judges 1 that we read, 6 times it says, uses the phrase drive out. They did not drive out, they did not drive out, they did not drive out the inhabitants of the land. See, only those who were committed to stay had stayed, and thus, because of that, they have a greater judgment, they reap a greater judgment of death against them. God had given them ample opportunity to leave. In Joshua chapter 2 verse 9, the spies have entered the Canaanite land. They know that they're going to attack Jericho, and Rahab hides the spies, and this is what she says to them. She says, I know that the Lord has given you this land, and that a great fear of you has fallen on us, that all who live in this country are melting in fear because of you. So God had given the people every opportunity to repent. He had given them every opportunity to leave. The people knew that the God of Israel had come upon this land in power, and that this was not their land any longer. He had given them every single opportunity. And finally he said, but if you will not leave, then you will reap this judgment. So God's answer to the apparent harshness, to his apparent harshness, is that we have not taken into consideration the horror of sin, or the stubbornness of man, or the righteousness and justness of God. Consequently, it's no surprise that when we see God's judgment upon those who have committed the same sins that we commit, that complaint and protest rises within our hearts. See, instead of driving them out, the Israelites drove themselves to compromise. They only partially obey God's command. They inhabit the land, yeah, but they don't drive out those who are living there. And one of the reasons, the first reason we're going to talk about today, is that they made an economic compromise. And when Israel became strong, chapter 1, verse 28, when Israel became strong, they pressed the Canaanites into forced labor, but they never drove them out completely. See, there was an economic advantage to oppressing the surrounding people. Free labor. Both skilled and unskilled jobs went to slaves. By enslaving their enemies rather than driving them out, the Israelites engage in this sort of economic compromise because their thinking is it's financially beneficial to keep them around. And I have to think that the what's going on in their mind is that, well, if we drive them out, then they're just going to go settle over there, outside the boundary of our land. And they're not going to be happy with us. And then they're going to fight, and they're going to get stronger, and they're going to attack us. So it's better that if we kill them, well, then we just there's nothing to be done there, and that's a little more difficult. So it seems like what we should do. See, God, what we really should do is, I know you said drive them out, but wouldn't it be awesome if we just enslaved them? You know, wouldn't that just show your power? Wouldn't that just show how mighty you are? That you are the beneficent God who graciously allows them life, who allows them to live in the land. If only they would just be our slaves. So here's what we have to do, because we have to remember there is no strict correlation between the church and Israel. The Israelites, slavery made life easier. And so if I can extrapolate that, then really that's what slavery is all about. Forcing people to do that you don't like, forcing people you don't like to do things that you don't want to do for your own personal gain. That's the general principle. The general principle is they compromise on God's command for their own economic personal gain. They used other people to achieve something that benefited themselves. They used other people for their own gain. So let's take that general principle and let's move it over into a modern context. what can we here in the 21st century, when can we find ourselves in a similar compromise? Can we ever find ourselves using other people for our own gain? Do we ever think of others more highly? Do we ever think of ourselves more highly than we think of others? Have we as churches or individuals compromised with the world for economic gain? That's a question that employees, that business owners, that church leaders have to always be asking themselves. Am I pursuing the economy of the empire or the economy of the kingdom? So I want to begin by giving you an example of Christian employees. We've actually been going through on Friday night in a small group study, and this was not intended at all. But we've been going through a series called Work as Worship. And last Friday we talked a little bit about being a Christian employee and what it means to be a Christian and what can be a secular profession. And one of the primary verses that we've been studying is Colossians chapter 3 verse 23 and 24. Whatever you do, work at it with all your heart as working for the Lord, not for human masters. Since you know that you will receive an inheritance from the Lord as a reward, it is the Lord Christ you are serving. See, what I get from that passage is very multifaceted, and I might focus on it in total some other time. But what I want to focus on here is that there is a mandate to work. We are to work. Work is not a non-Christian concept. We were created to work. It's not a product of the fall. It's not due to sin. It's not something that gets in the way of our Christian life. It's a part of who God made us to be. And this is really the issue. Because we take the concept of sacred and we say that the opposite of it is secular. And when we do that, when we divide what is sacred and what is secular, then we by nature, divide our lives into sacred and secular. We divide our lives into sacred time, when I'm at church, when I'm praying, when I am at Bible study, when I am in my own personal devotion, and then secular time, when I'm at school, when I'm at work, when I'm with my family sometimes. So there ends up being a division between when God is allowed in my life and when God isn't allowed in my life. But that's a false dichotomy because the truth is the opposite of sacred is not secular. The opposite of sacred is profane. Got that? The opposite of sacred is not secular. The opposite of sacred is profane. And when we take secular as being the opposite, what we're saying is that profane, what is profane and what is secular are the same thing, and that's absolutely not true. When we take what is secular and we think of it as being profane, then we're not going to see any usefulness in our jobs. We're not going to see any usefulness to anything outside of the church. And that's absolutely not true, because we end up confining our lives then to just what we feel like is spiritual, rather than using our lives so that in everything that we do, in our work, in our play, in all of our interactions, and making them spiritual and then transforming them. What I'm saying is, in particular here, if you are making this disconnection between what is sacred and what is secular, then you are not going to see any good reason to work. And then what that does is that provides in you is that then why do I work? And you're left without a sense of meaning. And you're left without a sense of purpose. And what most people turn to, Christians and non-Christians, when they do not see any purpose, inherent purpose in the work that they do, they do not find any joy in the work that they have, then why is it that they work? And the answer is, because I get paid. Because I get paid. And when you work for a wage, that wage becomes your God. When you work for a wage, that wage becomes your God. But this verse says you don't work for any human master, and you certainly don't work for money, but for God. And that tells me this, Christian employees, you cannot make salary your priority. The amount of money that you get should not be your sole or primary consideration for the job that you have. Now, I'm not telling you that it's wrong to make money. Go out there and make as much money as you want. Use it to impact the kingdom. I'm not saying that you have to allow yourself to be underpaid in your profession, that you can only make $40,000 a year or less, or else you're not holy, or whatever the number is, or anything like that. What I am saying is that if you are primarily concerned about the amount of money you are making, you will always be unhappy. Because there's always more money to be made. If you work for the wage, your job will seem tedious and deadening rather than joyful and uplifting. And when money is king, morals and ethics become second. When money is king, family and Sabbath become second. When money is king, God is not. You cannot serve both God and money. Those aren't my words. Those are Jesus' words in the Sermon on the Mount. So let me give you some examples of economic compromise. If you work so hard that your spiritual life is neglected, that's economic compromise. Because you show what you love by what you spend your time on. If you work so hard that you neglect your family, that's economic compromise. Now I get it, I really do, because there are times that you have to put in those hours. You have to do that work in order to provide for your family. And that's a wonderful thing. So you want to find that balance. You want to find the area there where you are doing both. See, God created you to work, but He also created you to rest. If your desire for money is so great that you falsify expense reports, that you fudge the tax numbers over here, that's obviously wrong, and it's economic compromise. You do not want to gain the whole world and lose your soul. The world is rife with stories of those that have done so, that they got everything they ever wanted and lost everything they ever needed in the process. To make money your God is to compromise spiritually with the world. Moving on to businesses, that proposition changes slightly. Should businesses pursue profit? Yes. But in the same way that individuals should, they should pursue profit for the proper purpose. Try saying that 5 times fast. Any business that makes profit its primary pursuit will ultimately fail. In fact, I'm going to suggest to you that profit should be third on any business's list of priorities, behind their customers and their employees. People first, profit second. Focus on the value that you can add to people. Think of profit as more than just money, and you'll have success. And I'll give you an example that I heard recently, and I was listening to Dave Ramsey on the radio, and he has this millionaire theme hour, where people call in who are now millionaires. They have $1 million net worth, and he interviews them, asks them questions, you know, how did you get here? How did you get to a point where you have $1 million? And one of the individuals that called in was a restaurant owner, and he had started off, you know, with one restaurant. It was called Highway 55 Burger Shakes and Fries. They don't have any in Oklahoma, I looked. They have a couple in Dallas. And he's got 100, and now he went from one store, and now he has over 150 stores, 150 restaurants that he has. And he talked about, you know, now he's worth millions of dollars. But when he started out, he was worth negative money. And he's like, I was working so hard, I was working 100-hour weeks, and I was told, you know, if you're passionate and you work hard, then you'll definitely be a success. And he's like, for years I've been passionate, I've been working hard, and I hadn't had that success. And he says, I just, one night I was praying, and I thought, I haven't been thinking of people. And he's looking, I got up, and on a scrap piece of paper, I scratched out a business plan that completely changed the way, the direction that I wanted to take my business. And 20 years after that time, not only has his business grown, but 50 of his 150 restaurants are now franchised, owned by people who started off making minimum wage in his restaurant. He took 50 people from a minimum wage restaurant job that they now own their own business. That's incredible. See, for years he tried to make a profit, he never succeeded. He changed his whole business model to focus on his employees, to focus on his customers. Not only did it make him a millionaire, and I'm not saying that he did it for financial gain. And I'm not saying that if you do the same thing, that you'll end up with the same financial gain. The point being is, he put value into people, and that's going to last far longer than money ever will. So employees, businesses, now churches. How do churches compromise economically? What can we do to make sure that we don't fall into the same trap? And that answer probably varies from church to church. And overall, I think the tendency that we can have, what we must really guard ourselves against, is a tendency to water down the gospel for the sake of money. You're like, well, you know, I don't want to preach anything too harsh because then you might not come back. Well, you know, I don't want to say anything that's going to offend. I'd rather be popular than prophetic. And I hope that's never been the case for me anyway from this pulpit. And to close, I want to tell you this story, because this to me really illustrates it all. Every time that I run across this story, when I think about it, it just gives me chills. Thomas Aquinas, the medieval theologian, was once scheduled to meet with Pope Innocent II. And this was at the height of the Catholic Church's decadence. Like, they had grown in political power. They had grown in their financial resources. The Catholic Church at the time was the most powerful political and financial institution in the world. And when Aquinas enters into the chambers of Pope Innocent II, then the Pope named Innocent is counting stacks upon stacks of gold coins, sorting through them to be put into the treasury. And he looks at Aquinas when Aquinas enters, and he says, Thomas, look at this. The church is no longer in the age in which it says, silver and gold have I none. Aquinas looks around, he says, this is true, Holy Father. But neither again can she say, get up, take thy bed, and walk. Economic compromise leads to spiritual weakness. Money is congealed life. How we spend it and how we treat it and what we think of it determines the kind of person that we become. So step one is economic compromise. And you can see how I justify that. Look, we're not following their calls for their gods. We just brought them in, and we're forcing them into our culture, to our gods. But step two is cultural compromise. And you look at Judges chapter 1, verse 29. Nor did Ephraim drive out the Canaanites living in Gezer, but the Canaanites continued to live there among them. See, almost immediately, the culture of the Israelites, as ordained by God, as written down by Moses, became influenced by the culture of the people in the land they were living. It did not take very long before the Israelites began adopting the culture of the Canaanites, before they began intermarrying with the Canaanites, before they began merging pagan practices with their current beliefs. And why did they do this? Why did they almost immediately lose their distinctiveness? And I think there's two reasons. Number one, for the sake of power. And number two, because they wanted to fit in. If there's one thing that I feel has been made abundantly clear in this political cycle, to me, it's that the Western Church is willing to compromise for the sake of political power. And I don't say this just to comment solely on the political process, because that is not my area of expertise. I can only comment on it in relation to the church. And back in June, Donald Trump, Republican nominee for president, met with evangelical leaders. But this is what he said. He did so because this is why he's doing it. Because you have to, he needs their vote. Obviously. He needs their vote. And let's be honest, he is not the kind of person that evangelicals would typically vote for. So he's with them, he's trying to convince them. that he's going to be the best person for the job, that this is why you should vote for him. And I'm not saying this to comment on the politics side of it. I'm commenting on the spiritual leader side of it. Okay? What did he offer them? What did he offer them? He offered them power. He offered them political power. I'll give you a quote from him. "I say to you folks, because you have such power, such influence, unfortunately the government has weeded it away from you pretty strongly, but you're going to get it back." The entire message that he gave them was, I will give you political power. I will give you political power. And it worked. During the Q&A, Dr. James Dobson, head of Focus on the Family, said that he was happy to be here with the gospel greats. And I'm like, I can't imagine Paul saying that. I can't imagine the Apostle Peter saying that. The closing prayer, the closing prayer by John Robinson said, "Father, I want to thank you for those who are standing out here. I pray that you would remove from any mind or heart any thought that we might be the smaller, more insignificant parts of your body, where I know for a fact it is highly likely that the more significant kingdom impact are those who are here in this room." That was a prayer? That was something that he was saying? Do you see what he's doing here? The whole thing was about how can the church gain political power? And it'd be laughable. It would be laughable to the early church to see what the modern church is trying to do. So since I'm apparently not among the gospel greats, let me remind them about something that they have forgotten. The church has always been at its weakest when it has held political power. The church has always been at its spiritual weakest when it has been at its political strongest. Political power makes for powerful men and a weak church. You see this played out in history. You saw this played out in the Catholic Church. You saw this played out in the Roman Empire, AD 300. Christianity, from the time of Jesus to the time of Constantine, it trudges forward in the persecution. It grows, and it grows, and it grows. It takes over nations. It turns the whole world upside down. Tertullian said, "The blood of the martyrs was the seed of the church." Through years and years of persecution, the church continues to grow. When does it stop growing? It stops growing when Constantine, Emperor of Rome, becomes Christian and says, now everyone has to be a Christian. When the cultural, political influence of Rome combined with the spiritual influence of Christianity, it was not Rome that grew stronger, it was Christianity that became weakened. Roman cultural practice wound its way into the church. Everyone was a Christian now. Not by proclamation of God, but by proclamation of the empire. Christianity lost its distinctiveness, lost its spiritual power. It gained the world, it lost its soul. In China, the church was persecuted for years and years, continued to grow exponentially. And while that church is still growing, it has slowed down because now the Chinese government is starting to recognize and legalize some forms of Christianity within the country. When the church seeks or receives political power rather than spiritual power, it begins to lose its effectiveness. The quest for power is not a spiritual quest, it's a carnal one. Unless the church disentangles itself from the quest for power, it will become great and it will become useless all at once. Second, the church is compromised for the sake of fitting in. Everyone feels a little awkward if you're the only one not doing something. We don't want to be made fun of. We don't want to be singled out. And in the church, the term that we tend to use is relevant. We want to be relevant. But that's not really what we mean, because being relevant is a good thing. What we tend to mean by relevant is entertaining. We are not harmful. Not challenging. People think the church is relevant if the world likes me, if the world understands me. But the opposite is actually true. The church is at its most relevant when it stands up to the culture and says, this is the line, you must not cross it, thus saith the Lord. Bernard Bell was a theologian in the mid-20th century. As a matter of fact, he writes this in 1942, right in the middle of World War II. He says that any significant impact of the church upon the day whose sun is sinking into a confusing twilight, or upon the tomorrow which struggles in the womb of night, must necessarily be an impact of challenge, of opposition. Do you get that? Do you get that? If the church is not challenging the political structure, if the church is not challenging the empire, if the church is not challenging the culture, we are no spiritually good. If we are not challenging what the world thinks about sin or social justice, we failed as a church. It is our job to adhere to the ethics of Christ. We must put others above ourselves. We must demand a call to holiness by those who call themselves holy. We must lay down our political rights in order to pick up the pieces of a broken world. We cannot cling to ourselves and help our fellow man. As the years trudge on, the church has begun to look more and more like the empire. Christian culture and secular culture have begun to blend together to where the only difference between the believer and the non-believer is where you sit at 10 a.m. on a Sunday morning. We have ceased to call out injustice. We have demanded compliance with our laws without offering the world a relationship with Christ. We want to fit in seamlessly with the culture. We want the predominant culture to be exactly what we believe, exactly to the extent that we believe it, because we want to be comfortable in our lives. We don't like it when the prophets challenge our status quo. Oh, we're all for it when the prophets shout out to the world. But how dare they ask the church to change? But it's easier to fit in. It's easier to say that you're in God's secret service rather than God's army. It's easier to say that the way of your political system is right rather than the way of God. It's easier, it's easier, it's easier. And that's where the church is at. It's simply been fitting in because it's easier. But here's what happens when you make culture your God. Here's what happens when you make politics your God. Here's what happens when the highest level of moral authority comes from your government or from your society. It begins to crumble and fall apart. Let me share with you these haunting lyrics from a band called King Crimson. I won't sing it. No worries. Knowledge is a deadly friend when no one sets the rules. The fate of all mankind, I see, is in the hands of fools. The wall on which the prophets wrote is cracking at the seams. Upon the instruments of death, the sunlight brightly gleams. When every man is torn apart with nightmares and with dreams, will no one lay the laurel wreath when silence drowns the screams? Confusion will be my epitaph as I crawl a cracked and broken path. If we make it, we can all sit back and laugh. But I fear tomorrow I'll be crying. Yes, I fear tomorrow I'll be crying. When we ignore our mandate to live as holy people in an unholy world, the result is confusion and chaos. Cultural compromise happens because it is easier, but it is not eternal. It always fails. Let me close this point with one more quote from Bell. Again, writing 70 years ago, 70 years ago, he says that it is because the church has thus obscured the socially prophetic note that it seems to most people to have no relevancy. The masses of the folk, observing the church as of late, the church has been willing to present itself, they say, there is nothing here to bother with. These people bear within themselves no salvation. They are as mad as all the rest of us. They are not worth listening to. They are not even worth crucifying. This compromise, economically and culturally, has led inevitably to a compromise spiritually. In Judges chapter 2, you begin to see the result of the people of God and their compromise. And God comes to them. So Judges chapter 1, beginning of chapter 1, God comes to them and says, Judah is supposed to go up. And then you have a whole chapter of where that didn't happen. Judges chapter 2 is the next time that God speaks, and this is what he says. The angel of the Lord went up from Gilgal to Bochim and said, I brought you up out of the land of Egypt into the land I swore to give you to your ancestors. I said, I will never break my covenant with you, and you shall not make a covenant with the people of the land, but you shall break down their altars. Yet you have disobeyed me. Why have you done this? And I have also said, I will not drive them out before you. They will become traps to you, and their gods will become snares to you. So the end result of compromise with the world was the loss of their distinctiveness. The end result of the church's compromise with the world is that we will lose our Christian distinctiveness. We will cease to look like the kingdom, and we will look more and more like the empire. We will cease to rely on kingdom directives and begin to rely more and more on the laws of the empire. We will begin to see the empire as our savior rather than the king. The gods of money, power, comfort, social status have ensnared us. The gods of popularity and rationalism have drawn us in. We have built an empire out of the church rather than a kingdom. This represents a great opportunity for the church, though. Because what we've seen in recent years is that the secular culture and the Christian culture have started to diverge. The Christian culture and the secular culture have started to diverge. And that, I think, is why many Christians today are so angry about secular culture and they want it back. But what we have to realize is that we were called to this Christian distinctiveness. We cannot expect people who are non-Christian to obey Christian morals and Christian precepts and Christian concepts because we have not preached to them Christ. They have no reason to obey or be a part of our culture because we have not shared with them the foundation of that culture in Christ. So this represents a great opportunity for the church. Today more than ever, because we have this opportunity to show our distinctiveness, to reclaim our distinctiveness. For years, the moral culture of the empire and the moral culture of the kingdom, by and large, agreed. America, it was recognized, was founded upon Judeo-Christian values, built on Judeo-Christian values, and that's all true. Even as the nation became more secular in a post-World War II world, it held on to that Christian culture and its fabric of society. But as the generations move on, it became harder and harder to hold that set of moral values with only the shaky foundation of culture to ground it. So culture began to change. As it altered our families, it altered our working lives, it altered our sexuality as everyone sought freedom to do whatever it is that they wanted to do. The Christian nation became not so Christian anymore. I want to suggest to you this. We, as American Christians, need to give up the idea of America as a Christian nation. We fought to keep it as such in our courts. We fought to keep it as such in our laws. We have not fought to keep it as such in the hearts of the people. Only when we go after the heart can we then try to reclaim the country. The path that this nation is on and the path that this church is on is one that will lead to divine judgment. God's treatment of the Israelites is not unique to them. He did so with the Canaanites. He did so with the Assyrians. He did so with the Babylonians. He did so with the Romans. He did so with the Greeks. He has done so with every world power that has ever come to play. This is what happened in the land of Israel. And he will do so with us as well. Judges chapter 3, verse 7 through 11. The Israelites did evil in the eyes of the Lord. They forgot the Lord their God and served the Baals and the Asheroths. The anger of the Lord burned against Israel, so that he said to them, so that he sold them into the hands of Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram-Naharaim, to whom the Israelites were subject for 8 years. But when they cried out to the Lord, he raised up for them a deliverer, Othniel, son of Kenaz, Caleb's younger brother, who saved them. The Spirit of the Lord came upon him, so that he became Israel's judge and went to war. The Lord gave Cushan-Rishathaim, king of Aram, into the hands of Othniel, son of Kenaz, who overpowered him. So the land had peace for 40 years until Othniel, son of Kenaz, died. Every time in the book of Judges, that the people served other gods, they came under divine judgment, under divine discipline for their actions. But God never left them alone. He never left them alone. He would raise up a deliverer, endowed with the Spirit of God to do the works of God to initiate a divine restoration. That's how God worked in the Old Testament. His Spirit would indwell specific people for a specific time and a specific purpose. But now he gives that indwelling of the Spirit to all his people for all times and all purposes. See, you, my friends, you are Othniel. You have been empowered by God for restoration. You can redeem this society. You can bring peace. You can bring revival. And if this nation is to survive, if Christianity is to survive, you must. Let's pray. Father, what's been laid out before us today is a challenge. It is not easy. It's hard. It is not natural. It is supernatural. It is not something that we can accomplish under our own power or under our own might, but only through your Spirit. Father, I just pray that you allow this to weigh heavily on us and that you grant us the power and the opportunity to work it out in our own lives, that revival might begin with us, that we not be swayed by the culture, but that instead we be culture changers, that we stand out and that we represent you to an unbelieving world. That we seek for power in the Spirit, even if that means laying down our rights and our power elsewhere. In the name of Jesus, I pray these things. Amen.